can please. Your health and well-being show here on Channel Radio. Channel Radio.
Big Ed Wings every Monday at noon on Channel Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Who Cares Wins on channelradio.co.uk with me, Jan Mulligan. Back in November, I attended the Wellbeing Symposium 2015. The day was full of fascinating talks, workshops and exhibition stands, and along the way I managed to grab a few interviews, one of which I've been teasing you with for a few weeks now, because I managed to pose the hardest question that Tanny Gray Thompson has ever been asked.
No. You know, I think that's the hardest question I've ever been asked.
Well, the wait is over, and in a moment you'll hear that question and her answer to it. But before that, I have the pleasure to play for you now part of the official talk she gave at the Wellbeing Symposium. At the end of the talk, you'll also hear the question and answer session that accompanied it. Tanny Gray Thompson is a Paralympian, crossbench peer in the House of Lords, broadcaster, journalist, amongst a whole host of other roles and tasks that she takes on. Her talk was fascinating, informative, and very funny. I hope you'll enjoy it as much as we did on the day.
And I started training, and I started working hard, and I joined a club, and I mostly loved it. It's great. To get to do something that you really love doing for such a long period of time is amazing. And being a full-time athlete is a huge privilege, because you have time to train and to eat and to do all the things that we all know we're meant to do, that lady mentioned there, you know. But being a full-time athlete gives you a huge amount of privilege. And yeah, we trained twice a day, 6 days a week, loads of training, covered in snot. To get you. The nice bits it got me is medals. But the reality of my sporting career is, if I add up the total length of time I competed on the track at Paralympic Games, and this defines my career as an athlete, it kind of defines what I do now, it's 20 minutes of my life. So one of the reasons I spend a lot of time talking about the things I do now and getting people to think differently is because the moments that you have to achieve, to really change things, are really small. Now, I'm also a bit of a drama queen. Everything I do is really, really important. But we're talking about priority. You know, everyone has to prioritise what they do. And for me, it's knowing when you have those moments that you can make a change, and knowing when you can say the right thing or do the right thing to bring that change. Because there are things, and lots of things, that we have to change in society at the moment and encourage people to think differently about what they do. Did I ever think I was going to end up in the House of Lords? Not really. Seb Coe, on the left. that has a big impact on sport and physical activity, the drugs cases in Russia. Because it makes parents think differently about the activities that they want their child to do. Do they, you know, as a parent, do you want your child going into a sport where you might be encouraged to take drugs? Possibly not. I have a 13-year-old daughter. Do I want her to go into a sport where actually I've annoyed a lot of people? probably not. So, you know, there's lots of things about how sport affects the way people think about what they do every day. Did I think I was going to go there? Well, no, I didn't. I actually did a politics degree at that great seat of political learning, Loughborough. I went there for sport. I very grandly said to my head of department just before I graduated, I'm never going into politics because politics is for losers. He sent me a lovely email which said, "Dear Tanny, loser." But actually what I learned over time is I'm not great at politics. I'm really not good at party politics. I'm a crossbencher, so I'm an independent, which is a hugely privileged position to be in. Nobody tells me how to vote. The absolute worst thing about it is nobody tells me how to vote. But actually what I've learned over time in sport is actually it's understanding the rules of the game, rules of engagement, who you need to speak to, who you have to call, who you have to write to, who you have to sit in front of. Possibly one of the most important things I learned in the last couple of years is I applied to go on the 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games Legacy Select Committee. I didn't get on. I thought I had a good chance. Somebody with a housing background got on. Actually, he was brilliant. And somebody said to me, okay, you're a bit annoyed. What you need to go and do is you need to go and have a cup of tea with every single member of that committee and tell them where the bodies are buried. I was miles more effective doing that than I was sitting on the committee. So it's figuring out what your strengths and weaknesses are. And again, sport teaches you to look at that all the time. Every training session, every week, every month, every year, you're looking at your strengths and weaknesses and where you need to improve. And that's where the training is incredibly good. So I ended up in the House of Lords 6 years ago. My first day, somebody came up to me and said, "Don't worry, this is just like boarding school." I went to a comprehensive in South Wales. I'm going, actually, it's weird, it's strange. It's full of some slightly mad people. And it's full of some of the brightest people I've ever met. It's also full of some of the most helpful people I've ever met in terms of giving me advice on the things that I want to achieve. But I went to do sport. I went to do things, legislation for the Olympics and Paralympics, Sunday trading, road closures. Great, really exciting stuff. And I sat there, and then, because I was interested, looked at the welfare reform bill and thought, oh, well, I'll have a go at that. Yeah, that was a baptism of fire. Did health and social care bill, did legal aid, and then started doing all these different things. And actually, when I started looking at all the different bits of legislation, for me, physical activity was a really important part of that. I remember sitting in the Academies Bill and talking about physical activity and somebody saying, "No, we're just talking about education." Sorry, don't you do physical activity in schools? Well, apparently not. So for me, physical activity started joining a lot of those things together. I was recently slightly misquoted. I said that anybody who was long-term unemployed should be made to do physical activity. I didn't say made. So it should be encouraged. Because actually, we know the benefits of well-being and health. You know, there are lots and lots of reports. If writing reports and strategies were Olympic sport, Britain would win. And I say that having had my name on lots of reports and strategies as well. But it's the doing bit. It's what Philip said. It's the doing bit and how we bring about that change by doing. 2 years ago, I was involved with a physical activity commission where it was the first time we looked at how we joined up physical activity with housing, with the built environment, with active travel, with walking to school, and all those different things. And for me, that was really important. And the blueprint we launched last week was an addition to that in terms of exploring in more detail. But, you know, there are 88 recommendations in that report. We can't do them all. We have to be really smart in terms of the things that we can change, but also in terms of the network that we can use to affect change. And that's the one thing I'd like to see. I mean, I'm fine standing up on stage speaking. If I'm made to go to a networking event, I would rather boil my head in a vat of vinegar than go and talk to people I don't know. Does anyone else feel like that? I really, really hate it. But actually, one of the biggest benefits of events like this is your chance to go and talk to people. So yeah, go and do that, even though... Because actually, you never know who you're going to meet, who can be that connection to bring about change. Or actually, the other thing I've learned in politics is sometimes there are things that I can't say, but you can get somebody else to say it. Or sometimes, I quite like being a bit stroppy and a bit controversial. You know, sometimes there are things that I can say that other people can't. So that network is incredibly important in terms about making the change happen that you want. And it is working together. The only way this will happen... when I kind of went into the Lords, I remember saying to someone, "Don't the departments just talk to each other?" And they all laughed at me. And now I've been there 6 years, you go, "Oh, okay, I get that." But there are tough times and tough choices. This picture's taken of me in Athens, and which is my last Paralympic Games. I knew it was going to be my last one. I hadn't quite figured out what I was going to do afterwards. But I spectacularly lost my 800-metre final, which was my strongest event. I'd been unbeaten over 12 years in that event. I made a split-second decision in the final, which was the wrong one. It's pretty bad. I decided for some unknown reason to block myself behind the slowest woman in the race. Came off the track, had a bit of a discussion with my husband. Row. Because he was like, "What were you doing?" And so anyway, yeah, I'll tell you about that afterwards. Luckily, that wasn't caught on television. But I remember leaving the track, and every single person who walked past me said, "That was really rubbish." And, "Yeah, no, I was there. Thanks." I was stopped by one chap who quite obviously had never run an 800 metres in 1:49 in his entire life, who told me the tactical mistake I made and what he would have done differently. And you go, "Yeah, thanks, I'll do that next time." And it's hard, because actually, for lots of people, you know, when you're doing well, it's great. When you're not doing so well, that kind of challenge can be really demoralising, and it can really make you question the things that you do. My team manager gave me the option of leaving the games and pretending I was injured or ill, and I said no, I was going to carry on, which I'm glad I did, because I won my next two finals. This is actually the picture taken of me just as I crossed the 100 metres after I won the gold medal. Not looking very happy at that moment. There was quite a lot of relief and other things there. But I think the things I've been through, again, in sport have taught me that you have to keep going, you have to believe, you have to question yourself, but also you need to have a huge amount of resilience. And when you've lost a race, when it's been shown live on TV and about 5 million people have watched, you develop resilience pretty quickly. You also develop it, because if you're in people's living rooms, they think you're part of the family. So fairly recently somebody said to me, didn't you used to be Tanny Gray Thompson? Yeah, hi. She also then pointed out she didn't recognise me because I was so much fatter than I used to be. Thank you for that. But actually, you know, my race weight as an athlete was 45 kilos. You know, on no level is that sustainable. Actually, on no level is that really terribly healthy. It's fine for the period of time you're competing, but it's not. So, you know, you kind of need that resilience, because some of the challenges that you guys face will be really difficult ones. There are lots of times when I feel like I'm smashing my head into a brick wall, that I knock down the brick wall, and then I build it back up again to smash my head into it again. So that resilience is incredibly important in the things that you're trying to do. And there are huge choices at the moment, and sometimes they're not even choices. The cuts to local authority could potentially have a huge detriment on leisure facilities. What's happening with, we've got another welfare reform bill coming to us fairly soon in the House of Lords. We look at what's happening in the NHS. I'm glad I've chopped out a big part of my speech because Philip covered it, which is great. But I was asked to do a piece of work recently on the provision of wheelchairs for disabled people. And I've seen lots of people who quite frankly, have really bad wheelchairs. And when I was asked to do it, they said, oh, it's really easy. All you have to do is just get a provision of wheelchairs in the NHS mandate. I went, OK. And then you realise what you have to do in terms of 209 CCGs, in terms of health and wellbeing boards. If somebody can explain to me on one page of A4 how all that works, I'd be really pleased. But actually, that's the bit that's the challenge. Because the lady talked about language and understanding. That comes back to the bit about you have to understand the field of play, the rules engagement, to figure out how you can get the best you can from it. And none of it's simple. I sat through about 60 days of welfare reform, where I was told that universal credit was going to be simpler. Yeah, it is simpler. Is it simple? Absolutely no, it's not. So, you know, I think there's a lot we need to do about removing some of the red tape. You know, there's other things we know. 80% of women aren't fit enough to be healthy. That has a massive cost to the workforce, to the NHS, to pensions. Campaigns like This Girl Can, it's incredible. The first time ever that a normal-sized woman has been shown on TV and advertising campaigns. This year is the first time that a normal-sized woman has been shown on the front cover of a running magazine. Because actually, what does it say to girls if what you see, okay, Jess Ann is, you know, massive six-pack, absolutely phenomenal, she's doing about a million sit-ups a week to get that. You know, what does it say to young girls if they think that they will be happy if they're skinny? Recent research has interviewed a huge number of young girls, and they were asked, you know, what would make you happy, being skinny or being healthy? They said being skinny. You know, so there's all these things that we have to try and challenge. Some of them can be changed pretty quickly. You put hair dryers in changing rooms in school, the participation of girls doing physical activity goes through the roof. So why don't we do it? Well, it's about cost, it's about them electrocuting. You know, there's all these reasons why we don't. But actually, it's not difficult to bring about those changes. And should I be telling a young girl who's 15 to go and do physical activity, have a shower in school, and then go back into school without drying their hair? No, because I didn't come here this morning without drying my hair, did I? You know, just, so, you know, we've just got to be a bit smarter about what we're doing with young people. Recent research showed that 79% of MPs believe that physical activity is really important. I'm going to go back to them this week and ask them how many of them do physical activity. Because actually, you know, I kind of figure as well, if I'm going to talk about being physically active, I also have to live that. My work-life balance is not great. you know, we work very odd hours in the House of Lords. We have lots of recess. But actually, being physically active is a really important part of my day. So I've now gone back to doing 10Ks. So I had a little bit of time out after I retired. And I have to say, you know, we used to do 10K warm-up before a marathon. We used to knock out a 10K without even thinking about it. These days, 10Ks are pretty miserable. They are. But I know I have to do a bit of training to do them, to be in one piece. I know I will feel better for doing it. I did one recently, and I got caught by a runner, which never used to happen. And it's like, and it's about refocusing. That's really important. So, and this guy was running alongside me. He went, "Oh, people like you. Oh, I really admire people like you." Okay. And he's like, "Yeah, because you've got out and with all the things that are wrong with you, oh, you get out and go, oh, lovely. Thanks very much." And then he said to me, "Didn't you used to be Tanya Grace Thompson?" And then he went, "You're really rubbish these days, aren't you?" Exactly. That wasn't quite the word he used. But it's about refocusing. And it's about, you know, living and breathing. It's about doing a little bit every day. Because that's the only way. Because I can't stand up and talk about it unless I'm doing it. Do I eat cake? Yes, I do. The point I could have eaten cake was when I was training 120 miles a week on the road. Maybe not now. But, you know, it's all about that balance. The debate about sugar tax. It's about legislation. You know, it's about, you know, obesity. We need to think about the health of our hearts as much as about the size of our weight. And the trouble is, we try to make things too simplistic. You can be larger, but you can be healthier. You can be skinny, and you can be incredibly unhealthy. So, you know, there's lots of things that we need to think about. But we have to have robust research, and we have to have a good argument. Sport has never been great at having a good argument about why we should do it. We've got medals, we've got all these different things, we've got feel-good factors. We've got the research, but we've never been great at providing that to a bigger audience. And finding out people's motivation for change. I can tell a group of unhealthy people that they need to be healthy. But actually, at what point do you have to do more one-to-one work with people to figure out what that change can bring about? We're having a discussion last week. We talked about dog walking and all this amazing research that's there for dog walking. And somebody around the table said, "Should we just give everyone dogs?" And someone was like, "Yeah, that'd be great." I went, "Oh, my God," you know, but yeah, maybe not. But it's finding out those things. And that's kind of the thing that excites me about the next few years, is about finding out the individual motivations that we can bring about change. Because we need to do it. Because, you know, there's lots of things that aren't sustainable if we don't do it. The other things I've learned from sport, you know, individual success is not about individuals. You know, me as an athlete, the only time I was alone was when I was out on the track competing or on the road. I had training partners, coaches, dietitians, a sport psychologist, actually, who was clinically trained, which was probably quite good. I had an amazing team of people around me. I trained with other elite athletes, but I also trained with people who, quite frankly, had no athletic talent in their body whatsoever. And I used to get asked quite a lot about why I trained with one individual, because he was pretty rubbish at sport and athletics. And it was because, actually, he was a huge motivator. He was the person who was the glue that held our group together. So on the track, he might not have been very good. But what we used to do, if we were doing 400 metres, we'd set him off and give him about a 200 metre head start. Or if we were feeling a bit confident, about 250. And then the rule was, whoever crossed the finish line first won. So it didn't matter that, you know, he'd only pushed sort of 200 or whatever, you know, or maybe 150 metres. It was about finding the ways that you can bring out the best of people. And again, sport makes you do that. Because when you've got this limited time to achieve, you can't afford to faff about. I've seen a huge number of athletes who didn't make the team because they didn't concentrate, they didn't pick the priorities, they didn't pick the things they had to do. And then ultimately, the only control I have, and I am a bit of a control freak, so the day I got married, I had a schedule for a wedding party for every 15 minutes of the day. Is anyone else a control freak? Does anyone else like books of lists? But you know, the only control I have is what I do. How hard I train, how long I spend writing speeches, how much research I do. It's down to me. And it's me not making excuses for the things I do. Communication, massively important. It's the networking, it's the other stuff. This is me wearing about £1 million worth of equipment doing the London Marathon 10 weeks after having my daughter. And they lost me on the course. And my husband was in the studio. Came through this very complex walkie-talkie system to find out where I was. And when I told him, his response was, "Is that only how far you've gone?" We had another row. Apparently, Steve Cram was quite shocked at my language. There were some very short words to my husband. But actually, figuring out how to communicate with people. So actually, Ian was my coach. And you know, it's not good to maybe tell your boss some of the things I told Ian. The other thing I learned is when one of my team managers told me that having a baby would make me soft, what you're not meant to say to them is, let me stick a bowling ball inside you, slash your stomach open and see how soft you are. That gets you suspended for a month. But it's learning those ways, and it's time to learn how to communicate with people, because it's not just the way that you want to say things, it's the way people take things on board. And that's what a huge amount that I learned from my group as well. Success in sport is gold medals, world records. It's me and Colin launching Commonwealth Games stamps. Never, ever be afraid to ask questions. I didn't ask the photographer how he was going to use this photo. This was on billboards in the centre of Manchester and was nearly responsible for killing my sister because she drove past it and went... She actually rang me and said, did you have that done just to embarrass me? No, I didn't. I've learned two important lessons. Actually, yeah, ask questions. Never, ever buy cheap foundation. And if you're going to be next to Colin Jackson, always get your eyebrows done. Lovely. But the asking questions is because it's really easy. I don't know anybody who is not incredibly busy in terms of what they're doing. All I ever do is add things to do my to-do list, and I cross a few things off occasionally. But it's actually understanding the direction of travel, it's understanding the priorities, and it's actually about taking time to do the things that will make a difference. And again, that's what sports teaches you. And this is my family motto. Yeah, it's not as cool as some of the people I share an office with, whose family motto goes back to 1066. But it's about having a goal and a dream. This is Welsh, if I don't know if that helps or not. It's about having a goal and a dream. It's about never being afraid to try. It's about never being afraid to put yourself on the start line. You will have moments when you're questioned, you're doubted. Things might not be going in the right direction. You might spectacularly lose an 800 metres in front of lots of people. But it's about having that confidence that you're doing the right thing. And it's about stepping up and wanting to make a difference in terms of the things you do. And there'll be some, you know, things along the way that are good and some things along the way that will not be so good that you'll learn from. But it's about believing that you're doing the right thing. And the last slide I'd like to show you is what's important to me. It's kind of sport. Sports, you know, as much as I say sport's dead, sport and activity is really important to me. My family is incredibly important, and so is my daughter. She's now 13. That's the last time she was willingly had a picture taken with me, I think. She doesn't know whether she wants to be a hairdresser or a human rights lawyer. She actually knows she doesn't want to be an athlete. She actually is a kayaker because I'm terrified of water, and she knows I can't coach her. I love her. But I do look at her and go, oh my God, I am so sorry for what I did to my parents, because it's all just coming back to bite me. But actually, the most important thing about this is I look at her and I want her to have better opportunities than I had. I want her to have better opportunities to be fit, healthy, to think about her own well-being. And what I don't want is her to have a lesser life expectancy than I did. And I do, I should say. Hopefully I do. Because actually, if we don't make a change, that is what's going to happen to our children and to our grandchildren. So if nothing else, for everyone who's got children, grandchildren, dogs, you know, we have to do it for them. We have to make that change. Thank you very much.
We've got time for a few questions. So does anybody want to start us off? Any questions to Tammy?
There's a lady.
Sorry, you have to wave your arm a little bit. Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah, thank you. And anybody else on this side? We get the microphone. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. I don't know about anybody else, but I had tears in my eyes, and I wasn't sure I could sit here for the rest of your speech, but that was very, very inspiring. Thank you so much. My name's Sharon Jones, and I am a third-year occupational therapy student studying at Canterbury Christ Church University. I wanted to ask you, have you had much input from occupational therapists, first of all?
A little bit when I first became paralysed. I was born with spina bifida, so I was born with a hole in the back of my spine, and my cord was exposed. And actually, as I grew, my spine collapsed and severed my cord, so it took about a year to paralyse me. So I had a little bit of input. But kind of the attitude back then was like, right, just get on with it. the biggest fight I had was for my father to get me a chair, because there were lots of the doctors were saying the only way I'd have a normal life was to walk with calipers and crutches, and I couldn't do anything. I mean, I couldn't get to school, I couldn't carry a drink, and it was my dad who said, look, you have to have a chair. I did have one physio who, it was a very short meeting, but she basically said, do you know what a pressure sore is? I'm like, no, because I was seven. And she showed me this picture of a pressure sore that was like that. And she went, you get one of these, you'll die. okay. Look, and it was like, look after your skin and do it. And that sort of came around the time my parents were there. That came about the time my dad started saying, right, you need to be active and circulation. And lots of things he didn't talk to me about. But I think actually now, hopefully it's much better. And the input into people with spinal cord injuries and physio and stuff like that is really important in terms of what you teach people.
Yeah, it's a question for us out there. Is there anyone else over this side?
Hello, my name is Rebecca Beard and I'm actually a member of the Wellbeing People team. And I just wanted to pick up on something you said that I found really poignant. I've been really fortunate this year to be on the Health MOT Roadshow. And something you mentioned about doing more one-to-one work really struck with me. Yeah. We often meet people from a lot of different backgrounds, especially vulnerable ones, yeah. that do need that one-on-one.
Yeah.
We see so many that say, my GP's told me to lose weight. Well, that's great, but I have no idea how to do that. Or, actually, I've heard one thing from this person, and then I've been to somewhere else and they've told me something else. And actually, I think from what I've learned, they do need it to be simplified. There's so much information out there on what is right, losing weight, but actually, is someone's heart and their heart health being missed out on? So I just wanted to say it's really good to hear that there are people picking up on the fact that normal, everyday people, especially those in vulnerable backgrounds, don't have that one-to-one. But I think going forward, if we are going to make this country healthier, not just physically but internally, I think that's something really key that does need to be followed up with.
I think it's really hard because when the sort of move to asking GPs to prescribe sort of fitness and, you know, actually, do they have the training to do it? I can sit down and write a year's periodized training program for what you want to do if you're training to be a Paralympian. I find it much harder to tell somebody who's very inactive what to do. If you look at what's happening in primary schools, so, I mean, these are really gross generalizations. We now know girls drop out of activity at the age of 8. They just do it for a bit longer because they're forced to in school. So if that girl who's disengaged at 8 goes to become a primary school teacher, they'll be lucky if they get 4 hours instruction to how to deliver PE. And when you've got 35-year-olds, which is like herding sheep, who all have hugely different levels of physical literacy and physical activity, it's a nightmare. If maths was being taught in school by someone who stopped doing it at 8 and had 4 hours instruction, there would be uproar. But because sport physical activity is sometimes seen as frivolous, then it's not seen. So actually, we need to help GPs. I would radically change teacher training, you know, and there's some things, again, that could just be done really easily. But, you know, it's hard, I think, when people are being expected to prescribe things but they don't have the knowledge. One of the things in the blueprint, we said we would like a physical activity expert in every GP surgery. I think it was going to cost about $150 million, because obviously there's loads of money swishing around to do that. But actually, it's making sure they don't get to the GP in a good way, yeah. You know, that some of those things are stopped before it turns into diabetes. I've got an older sister, you know, exactly the same upbringing. She's the least competitive person you have ever met in your life. She doesn't care about competition. She was born with dislocated hips, and so has had problems with her weight and exercise. Her GP told her, you know, a month ago, you need to walk. Well, one of the reasons she can't walk is it's just joining up some of those things. You know, Anita didn't have time to read your notes from 48 years ago to find out what the problem was. So, you know, it's sort of, yeah. Sorry, I could talk forever.
Okay.
Hi, Ben McGann and Wellbeing People. Hi, Tanny. In terms of your career, which have you found more difficult, winning gold medals on the track or being a parliamentarian? And also, as a parliamentarian, what is your gold medal goal?
It was easier winning gold medals, bizarrely, because you were in control of more of your own destiny. You know, you knew 2 years out the time of day that you were going to be competing in that final. So you could plan the weather and you could plan performance trends of other athletes and figure out what surface the track was, and there were loads of things that you had control over. Now, I mean, I sat through 40 days of the localism bill. My amendment was the last but one of the bill, and when we got to it, everyone wanted to go home early, so they just agreed it. I didn't even have to speak. And you're like, you could have told me that 40 days ago, couldn't you? So some of that, but for me, it was learning the rules, and actually I spent a lot of time early on learning the rules and what colour carpet you couldn't stand still on and who to speak to and where the power is. So, that's a bit harder because it's so much is in other people's hands. And it all depends what the government of the day wants to do. So kind of my role as a crossbencher, I'm pretty much, I will be forever in opposition because I'll be opposing somebody. So that's sort of harder. My gold medal in legislation would be, and this is a bit odd, it would be to make it a criminal offence to park in a blue badge space without one. Now, I recognise sending people to jail for doing that is a bit harsh. However, it's more about the tone, and what it, because actually, if you go to the United States, people do not park in a blue badge space. And it's about respect and it's about understanding. And with all the stuff we've been through with welfare reform, and how much the 2012 was amazing, and it has shifted the dialogue around disabled people. Disability hate crime is the worst it's ever been in 10 years' reporting. So the attitude to disabled people is not terribly equitable. So for me, maybe not send people to jail, but at least be able to find them. And then actually, you know, people like the supermarkets who say they have a tough stance on it, but they don't really because it's just a PR campaign. I'd like to kind of hold them to account a bit more. So for me, if you change that, it changes actually equality in society and it moves on to a better place.
Great, thank you.
Brilliant.
Did you want me? Thank you, Tanny. Great
talk.
Thank you.
Who cares when you lose? Your health and well-being show here on Channel Radio. Channel Radio. Channel Radio.
Who cares when? Every Monday at noon on Channel Radio.
On the bright side.
And there we had Tanny Gray Thompson's inspirational speech from the Wellbeing Symposium 2015, back in November. Well, as you know, each week we asked our guests to name some music that they'd like to be played throughout the show. And this week I've cheated a bit. I've gone back through the archive and I've found Tanny's Desert Island Discs recording from 2001. And I've selected a couple of tracks from that show, first of which is Depeche Mode with Personal Jesus.
Reach out, touch space. Thank you.
and touch faith.
Who cares when we lose? Your health and well-being show here on Channel Radio. Channel Radio.
Who cares when? Every Monday at noon on Channel Radio.
And welcome back to Who Cares Wins with me, Jan Mulligan, and the first of our Wellbeing Symposium 2015 compilation shows. So, it's that time. You're about to find out the hardest question that Tanny Gray Thompson's ever been asked.
Such a fascinating talk, and very, very pleased to have heard you today. A couple of quotes that you had.
Yes.
I love your aim high, even if you hit the cabbage. And you say it's a Welsh saying.
Well, it's my grandfather. We've no idea where it came from, really. But he used to say it to me all the time. And particularly when I became paralysed, because he was hugely positive influence. So, yeah, it was about this kind of goal and dream. And we've kind of made it into what we wanted to make it into. Because we just thought that's what lots of people said, and then actually it was just my grandfather.
Well, I love it. I'm going to adopt that one. And the other fascinating thing, having, say, watched you for what felt like hours, and loving every minute of the hours I was watching you, but you're only on the track for 20 minutes.
Yes.
And that's just mind-boggling.
Paralympics. Yeah, so everything else I did was loads, but that was the most important thing for me. And, yeah, that sort of dictated my training and dedication. All the other decisions I made around training, competing, what else I did, was because of this limited time to achieve. And I think sport in that way is easy because that's such a focus, where in working life it's quite difficult to figure out. So you might have your priorities, your KPIs, your boss's priorities, something is urgent, something is important, something that you're trying to avoid doing. You know, there's all these different things that kind of muddy that and make it difficult, where in sport, when you break it down from, you've got your Paralympics and then all these other bits that you have to do, and it ends up actually being in a sort of a pyramid shape, you know, then it's easier to figure out what those building blocks are.
Right.
So that's what I try and do now in the stuff I do now.
And you mentioned quite bravely that since giving up sport, eating cake is not as easy now as it could have been there because you're not doing the activity.
Yeah.
And one of the stats you gave us was 80% of women are not fit enough to be healthy,
which
again is quite startling. I'm aware of your involvement in UK Active, and I saw on your news blog this week that you've got the blueprint for an active Britain with the fundamental truths. I wonder if you could give us a taster about that work.
I've only been chair of UK Active for 6 months. But it's really about highlighting what the issues are, because the lady who said in the audience, you know, people know what to do, they just don't do it. It was kind of bringing a lot of that together and bringing lots of different bits of research together, and highlighting the changes that can be made. So, you know, a head teacher maybe hasn't thought about active travel to school, or hasn't thought about how you can make your history lesson activity as well, and it's just trying to help people be creative and think differently about what they're doing. Because again, when you're sort of stuck in the mire of whether it's you know, curriculum or work or the things that you know you're meant to do and the things that you do, that there can be a huge disconnect. And UK Active is sort of really broad body. We have lots of different members and associates who. And it's trying to help them figure out the bits that they can do. But we also recognise that we need all those different people's help to bring about the change. You know, but the fundamental truth is Britain is not as active as it thinks it is. It loves sport, it loves watching sport, and we have to change that, the language. Because I used to say sport when I meant physical activity, but actually what I really mean is physical activity, and then that drives lots of other things.
And link again to your saying that a lot of people don't do activity, and your comment to Ben about the blue badge parking spaces, that people who are quite able to walk want to be as close as possible so that they don't have to walk.
Yes.
And that's your one of your pet bugs and your aim for the future, your gold medal of life is to...
to make it a criminal offence, which is a bit harsh.
A round of applause for that one. So.
Yeah, I'm probably never going to get it made a criminal offence, which it's probably quite right, really. But it's actually, you know, I need a wide space because I need to be able to open the door of my car to the widest possible degree to be able to get my day chair out. and if somebody parks really close to me, I'm likely to smash their door in, either with my door or with my chair. So for me, I don't need a space that's close to the door. I could have it in the middle of the car park, I'd be fine. But it's understanding, again, it's understanding what it's there for and what purpose it serves. And I think just, you know, there are some people who think it's their right to have immediate access to the NHS, and I actually do believe the NHS should be free at the point of delivery. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't because of some of the medical interventions I've had. But it's people understanding what the state's role, the role of the state is, and their role. And actually, they can be more physically active. They can be in charge of their destiny. You know, they can be in charge of, to a greater or lesser degree, about their long-term health. You know, there's some things that are unavoidable, but there's lots of things that are avoidable. And at the minute, I do worry that we kind of blame everyone else. You know, we blame school for children not being active, or we blame lots of other people, when actually, I think the individual has to take some responsibility.
So that's your kind of, it would be great if we could do that. You're on lots of boards, doing lots of jobs, and you've just mentioned one job you didn't get, but you found other ways of influencing.
Yeah.
Is there a job, a task you would like to do that you haven't been offered?
Ruler of the universe.
That's my job.
Do you know what? That is a really, really hard question. Being chair of UK Active is a really good place for me at the minute, because it's I get to talk about physical activity and how it impacts on lots of things. So that's the bit that Joe DeBroffer from Disability Rights, Unemployment, Housing, Built Environment, you know, so it's my excuse to talk about lots of different things. But also I passionately believe that we have to change the culture and the individual kind of belief system. So at the moment I'm really happy where I am, but
so we can take a rain check on the answer.
We
maybe interview in a year's time, see if that's changed.
No. I think that's the hardest question that I've ever been asked. I wouldn't mind being Minister for Physical Activity.
Minister for Physical
Activity. It doesn't exist as
okay,
a post.
So we need to campaign for that then.
But what it would mean, I'm afraid, it would mean me slightly dismantling Department for Culture, Media and Sport, Department for Health, Public Health England would be kind of... So I would have a huge portfolio.
It's doable.
Yeah. Deputy Prime Minister.
Okay.
Impossible for me to be, seen as I'm a crossbencher. That shouldn't stop you.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
Your health and well-being show here on Channel Radio. Channel Radio. Be Ed Wynn every Monday at noon on Channel Radio.
Well, not much I can add to that, I don't think. I'm going to go straight into another piece of music, again selected from Tani's Desert Island Disc show in 2001. This is Soft Cell and Tainted Love.
is your health and well-being show here on Channel Radio. Channel Radio. Channel Radio. Who says wind? Every Monday at noon on Channel Radio.
And welcome back to Who Cares Wins. Part of the Wellbeing Symposium this year was a panel, sort of question time, and one of the panel guests was Helena Conabeer from the Alcohol Education Trust, and I was fortunate enough to catch up with Helena after the panel session and to interview her about the work of the Trust.
I'm the director of the Alcohol Education Trust, and we are quite a small charity, just 8 part-time members of staff. We actually manage to provision over 2,000 schools across the UK, but also 700 other organisations. That includes youth clubs, sports clubs, other charities working with young people or with parents. And basically there are 3 ways that we work. As a small charity, it's impossible for us to reach children directly. We work with 11 to 18-year-olds, over 3.6 million across the UK that we feel are appropriate for our programme. So we have specialist regional members of staff who are teachers and parents and governors. And first of all, they train teachers who know their pupils well and so understand the risks and the issues there to feel confident about teaching that alcohol education. So we have our Bible, if you like, is a 100-page teacher workbook, and we then just allow the teachers to feel confident in how to use it. It's fully supported online with film clips and implementation advice, how to know whether you're doing it correctly, what we call, we even have an area about sort of inspiring best practice from other schools so they can watch or look at lesson plans that other schools have put together. Second element, we have very much a holistic approach. It's no good us just working with schools if we don't work with the community and parents. So we do hold parent advice sessions around talking to their kids about alcohol in schools and in community settings so that families can reinforce the school's teaching around staying safe around alcohol. And thirdly, the last thing that pupils or children want is being told that, you know, if you drink you're going to get liver disease, and you pick up a, you know, or hold up a picture of a diseased liver, or an ex-addict, for example, may come into school and talk about their life story. So it's like a moral tale. If you do this, you'll end up like me. Now, children are fascinated, but they say, well, I'd never be stupid enough to behave like that. So it doesn't relate to their own lives. So all our materials are around understanding where the kids are coming from. So we involve them in role play, actually looking at a short film and then applying it to their own lives. What would they have done differently? Working in groups, standing up and actually having fun. It's all around activity and having fun rather than the teacher talking about a substance misuse issue. It's what we call bottom up. We call it bottoms up because it relates to alcohol. But it's all starting with the kids themselves, then the teachers feeling confident and empowered, and we're just there to give the advice and support.
And throughout England, UK?
Throughout the whole UK. Our staff can only cover England.
Right.
So we have a lovely lady based in the northeast, in Hartlepool, where alcohol harms are highest, for example. Catherine is then based in the northwest, so she covers big cities like Liverpool and Manchester. And then Helen is based in Hampshire, and she covers sort of London and the southeast. And then myself and the chair of trustees cover the southwest.
And you gave us almost a horrifying statistic that in teacher training,
In teacher training, so the whole structure of teacher training has changed. So it's less sort of college based, more school based now. But within the teacher training structure, we carried out a survey to see how many teacher training colleges or universities covered the topic of personal, social and health education. And it was terrifying. You know, 7 of those 55 colleges had any input at all. So this happened because there is an extremely good programme in place at Southampton University. And all they have is a health and wellbeing day where they invite lots of partners to come along, including ourselves, the St John's Ambulance, there's laughter yoga, and the teachers just have a go. There are workshops and they learn about the principles of what social, personal, social and health education is and why it's important. And it's because
if children are more confident about reducing risk-taking, knowing more about themselves, feeling that the school cares, they therefore take less risks and get better results.
Absolutely.
So that's where we start. So we're trying to encourage through Public Health England, through the Department for Education and through the PSHE Association to encourage schools and colleges to just take that on board.
Like so many charities, in a way your mission is to do yourself out of work.
Yes.
How realistic is that?
Well, it's true. It's already started, which I'm very pleased about. So underage drinking is actually halved over the last 10 years. So we actually have a cohort now of children who are drinking less, smoking less, and engaging less in risky behaviours. But of course, those behaviours are still there. We believe that you need to tackle the whole class. So there are specialist charities who deal with children of families of alcoholics, for example, or who will deal with children who have specific drinking problems that may, you know, may start from age 11. We deal with the whole class because 88% of adults drink in the UK. You know, we are very much a wet culture, and alcohol is everywhere. It's on our TVs, it's glorified in films like Hangover or, you know, The In-Betweeners, everything. You know. So children need to understand that something is that is all around us in our society. It's something they have to learn to handle. So in a sense, we'll never be put out of a job because we're trying to teach the whole idea of taking personal responsibility, understanding how much is too much, why they should wait till they're older if they do choose to drink, because the liver and the brain isn't fully developed and therefore alcohol has a physical effect, but also you're more likely to make rash and silly decisions around other risk-taking because alcohol is a disinhibitor. Therefore you think, oh yeah, come on, I'll have a go, let's go and jump off that bridge or try that legal high. So I don't think we'll ever do ourselves out of a job, but we're very, very pleased that the environment is improving and less young people are choosing to drink at ages 11 to 15.
Who cares? Your health and well-being show here on Channel Radio. Channel Radio. Channel Radio. Who cares? Every Monday at noon on Channel Radio.
And there we had my interview with Helena Conover of the Alcohol Education Trust. That brings us to the end of our first Wellbeing Symposium 2015 show. There'll be more to come, so watch out for our Facebook and Twitter feeds, and we'll let you know the dates of future shows. I couldn't let the show end today, though, without letting Tanny Gray Thompson have the final word with her inspirational thoughts on how we can help ourselves, our families, and each other achieve better well-being.
I've learned two important lessons. Actually, yeah, ask questions. Never, ever buy cheap foundation. and if you're going to be next to Colin Jackson, always get your eyebrows done. He's so lovely. But the asking questions is because it's really easy. I don't know anybody who is not incredibly busy in terms of what they're doing. All I ever do is add things to do my to-do list and I cross a few things off occasionally. But it's actually understanding the direction of travel, it's understanding the priorities, and it's actually about taking time to do the things that will make a difference. And again, that's what sports teaches you. And this is my family motto. Yeah, it's not as cool as some of the people I share an office with, whose family motto goes back to 1066. But it's about having a goal and a dream. This is Welsh, if I don't know if that helps or not. It's about having a goal and a dream. It's about never being afraid to try. It's about never being afraid to put yourself on the start line. You will have moments when you're questioned, you're doubted, things might not be going in the right direction. You might spectacularly lose an 800 metres in front of lots of people. But it's about having that confidence that you're doing the right thing, and it's about stepping up and wanting to make a difference in terms of the things you do. And there'll be some, you know, things along the way that are good and some things along the way that will not be so good that you'll learn from. But it's about believing that you're doing the right thing. And the last slide I'd like to show you is what's important to me. It's kind of sport. Sports, you know, as much as I say sports dad, sport and activity is really important to me. My family is incredibly important, and so is my daughter. She's now 13. That's the last time she was willingly had a picture taken with me, I think. She doesn't know whether she wants to be a hairdresser or a human rights lawyer. She absolutely knows she doesn't want to be an athlete. She actually is a kayaker because I'm terrified of water, and she knows I can't coach her. I love her. But I do look at her and go, oh my God, I am so sorry for what I did to my parents. Because it's all just coming back to bite me. But actually the most important thing about this is I look at her and I want her to have better opportunities than I had. I want her to have better opportunities to be fit, healthy, to think about her own well-being. And what I don't want is her to have a lesser life expectancy than I did. And I do, I should say. Hopefully I do. Because actually, if we don't make a change, that is what's going to happen to our children and to our grandchildren. So if nothing else, for everyone who's got children, grandchildren, dogs, you know, we have to do it for them. We have to make that change. Thank you very much.